la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Kid. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
Hi, I'm Andrew Geller, host of Unbroken Chain, Music of the Grateful Dead and Friends, noon to 2, the third Saturday of every month. Throughout August, we're bringing you special episodes of our program to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the show. And KBOO is raising money for a new Studio Transmitter Link, or STL, to bring sound to listeners. Tune in Saturdays, noon to 2, and text GDAF to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/grateful to contribute to this one-time campaign. Thank you for your support for Grateful Dead and Friends and KBOO Community Radio.
Make sure to like and subscribe, times like now, wherever you get your podcasts. Spotify, Pandora, Google Casts, and more. On this episode, Louis Gong, activist, artist, teacher, entrepreneur, and owner of Eighth Generation, a Native American-owned company based in Seattle, Washington. On this episode of Times Like Now.
Hello, Louis Gong. Thank you so much for joining me here today on Times Like Now. How are you?
I'm doing great, Trevor. Thanks for having me.
So I first was introduced to your work when you were having kids in school painting on their shoes. Mm-hmm. Now you're doing traditional Salish and traditional Native designs upon shoes with kids, and I think I caught an article in the paper or maybe a video online somewhere. Tell me a little bit about your past, your history, and how Eighth Generation became your thing.
Oh, absolutely. So my name is Louis. I'm Nooksack tribal member, and I was raised in my community by my grandma and grandpa. And I never thought of myself as being an artist. You know, a lot of Whatcom County schools where I grew up were focused on sports. And so I think a lot of the interest and aptitude that I had in the arts went overlooked when I was a young person. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s working in higher education at Muckleshoot Tribal College in Auburn, just south of Seattle, that I started exploring art. And it was when the Muckleshoot tribe was hosting the intertribal canoe journey that many people probably have seen on the news or maybe been out to one of the very huge cultural events that are associated with the canoe journey. They were making drums for giveaway items at the canoe journey at the tribal college, and I participated in that process. And just like all the elders and language students that were making the drums, I started with a hide, composed a drum, set it to dry, and then painted it for the first couple times. But when people saw I had an aptitude for painting, they said, "Hey, Louis, why don't we just make the drums and you paint them?" And so over the course of about 3 or 4 months, I painted about 30 drums. And it was that experience with the Muckleshoot tribe when I was in my early 30s that really awakened this love of Coast Salish art. And that's the art of the region that we live in. Coast Salish is a really important term to know if you have any interest in Native art or culture. It's an anthropological term, but it's really useful, and it describes the basically a language and culture group that extends from southern British Columbia on the west side of the mountains all the way down to about Portland area. And it's different from Northwest Coast, which is where totem poles are from. It's a really important distinction. at any rate, once this love of Coast Salish art was awakened, I'd be like driving home in my commute from Auburn to Seattle every day, and I could see Coast Salish design elements in everything, like in the backs of cars, and I'd be sitting in traffic and look at someone's face in the car next to me and see Coast Salish design elements composing their face. You know, it was really clear how our ancestors saw the world when developing this art style. At any rate, another thing that I was interested in and had always been drawn to was custom shoes. I'd always looked at shoes that people had drawn on as being really cool and also really accessible. You know, you didn't have to have art training to try this out. And so very early on, I drew on a pair of shoes. And this is related to my mixed heritage and also my work around multiracial identity. It's a whole nother track of my career. But for many years, I did a lot of work trying to raise awareness about the experiences of people of mixed heritage. And I was raised by my grandpa, who's Chinese, my grandma, who's Native. My mom is white. And so I had a really dynamic experience around identity and spent a lot of my adult years in nonprofit leadership trying to validate the experiences of other people who are also of mixed heritage. So when I started doing art, although I was loving Coast Salish art, I always had this interest in using Coast Salish art to express an honest version of my identity and not try to replicate what I thought an anthropologist might stamp as Coast Salish approved or what more traditionalists might think is authentic. I wanted to do something that was truly a representation of myself. So I went to the store and was looking at shoes, and I found a nice blank pair of Vans one day, which was my favorite shoe at the time. And I brought those home and I grabbed a Sharpie and I tried to draw on them in a way that reflected my identity in an honest way. And what came out was this really contemporary Coast Salish art on Vans. I was very, very proud of them, even though that first pair was not very good. But when I wore them to the tribal college where I was working at the time, everybody was like, man, where'd you get those? Those are sick. And how can I get a pair? And that was the beginning of Eighth Generation. So originally I made Eighth Generation I created Eighth Generation as a way to sell the shoes I was decorating with cultural art while still working in higher ed administration at Muckleshoot Tribal College.
So what does Eighth Generation represent, and what does it mean, the phrase, the term, to you?
Eighth Generation is a name that I chose very purposefully. It has tons of meaning for me. Eight, when you say it in Cantonese, sounds just like the word for prosperity. So eight is a very lucky number to have in your business name. And so I incorporated eight as a way to pay homage to my grandpa and my Chinese heritage. And Eighth Generation is a play on this intertribal value of seven generations. In rudimentary terms, it is basically a decision-making framework that says you should consider the consequences of your decisions seven generations into the future. So by calling the business Eighth Generation, in my mind, I'm paying respect to the previous seven generations and sort of recognizing that I'm standing on their shoulders.
I see. So Eighth Generation now based, or has a store, I should say, in Seattle, down at Pike's Place. When did that open?
Our store at Pike Place Market, which is it's a beautiful little boutique shop in the area they call the Atrium. That was opened in 2016. That was 1 year after we did what is probably the most groundbreaking thing that Eighth Generation has ever done, which is launch wool blankets. So we became the first Native-owned company to offer wool blankets in 2015. The store at Pike Place Market followed in 2016. Between the time where I started drawing on shoes and, you know, established the entity Eighth Generation and the store opening, there was tons of work that happened. It's kind of a blur for me, and I sort of describe that time as like a montage in the movies where the music, you know, starts to pick up and you see the main characters sort of working together, kind of like what we used to see in the A-Team. I guess I'm dating myself that way, but
oh no, for sure.
I have no business training. I didn't have any people in my family who had business experience. I'd never thought of even entering into business. But for me, when I started selling my shoes, I recognized that all the pathways in front of me that are traditionally available to Native artists were laden with middlemen. So there wasn't one direction that I could go that I didn't have to go through a gallery or a company or an organization. And essentially, in going through them, what I mean is you have to ask for permission or validation that what you're doing is okay. And I decided early on that I didn't want to participate in that kind of system. You know, if I have skills and resources and my work's in demand, I didn't want to use it to strengthen a system that has never been designed to support people who grew up like me. In fact, the system, in my mind, is a very powerful tool for reinforcing existing power structures. A lot of them race-based. So for example, indigenous art is super popular. Native people make art, non-native people own galleries. And there's an exchange of privilege that happens where if you have the knowledge, if you have access to capital, the knowledge about how to communicate with people who have the socioeconomic means to buy art from a gallery, you can exchange that for 50, 60% of the value of an art that an artist created. So I didn't want to support that system. I felt like I could look back on 100 years of the gallery system in the Pacific Northwest and recognize that it has only worked for two or three people. So what I decided to do was focus on products. And I started off with the first investment that I made in myself after saving up money from doing the workshops that you mentioned, which were around exploring identity through shoe customization, was a laser. And I think my first laser was about $14,000, and it was all the money I had at the time. But as soon as I had that laser, I started to put the ideas that I had together around art and product development really creatively, because people with my sort of cultural background and worldview really hadn't had access to production a whole lot in the past. And so what I created really looked new to people. And so I started having success right away. Once I started having that success, I started helping other artists do the same thing. A lot of people said, why are you helping other people? You're just getting started. but it has always been like the education piece and the service piece have always been really enticing to me. Anyway, that help of other artists became the foundation of 8th Generation and ultimately led to the Inspired Natives Project. So 8th Generation is now one of the fastest growing Native owned businesses in the United States or Canada. We have a store at Pike Place Market. We're the first Native-owned company to ever offer wool blankets. And our business exists at the intersection of art, service, education, and modern business practices.
Yeah, your Inspired Natives Project, the tagline or the quote that we have here is that you had created, support inspired natives, not native inspired. That's a very powerful statement and says a lot in just a few words, because as we know, there is a lot of imported or knockoff, we'd call it, native work, arts out there. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that. Where did that come from?
Yeah, so the market for products featuring native art has been dominated by non-native companies almost exclusively using fake native art for hundreds of years. And when I tried to bring my art to market, I realized that, you know, if I ever wanted to explore wholesale, there's no room for me because the shelves at stores who want to sell products with native art on them are already full with really established companies who are making product with fake art. So for example, I had a workshop collaboration with this Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., the National Museum of the American Indian. And when I called their gift shop coordinator to see if they'd be interested in carrying eighth generation blankets, he said, "We already have Native blankets." And of course, he was talking about Pendleton blankets. And there was never any exploration of the sort of origin of the art on the blanket or the value of supporting a Native-owned company versus a non-Native-owned company. And so through my journey, I've not only had to sort of carve a new pathway for a Native artist to make a living from art, but I've also had to take on education of people who control opportunities associated with Native art on products. One of the ways that I have done that is establishing the tagline, "Inspired Natives, not Native inspired." It's catchy and informative, and it's been a really powerful tool in educating consumers about the importance of supporting Native artists and Native-owned businesses, and taking one, you know, maybe three extra seconds to ask, who is the artist? Because if the artist is not on the label, if it's not included on the website description, then it's fake Native art. And most consumers want something that's authentic, and they want their money to be, they want their money to support things that are aligned with their values, not to undermine them. So by taking a, if they hear that tagline a few times, next time they're in front of that product or reading a description on the website, they're going to take that extra 3 seconds to see if they can find the artist name.
Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you actually have some cease and desists and having some real issues with some of those plastic, soulless corporations that are, as you described. Tell me more about that. What's going on there?
Well, so let me back up a little bit. So Inspired Natives, not Native Inspired, is related. To understand the value of that term, you also have to understand the American Indian Arts and Crafts Act. And to make a long and complicated story very quick, it's a truth in advertising law that says that you can't call something Native if it's not. And so large corporations like Pendleton and many others, they use the term Native American inspired or Native inspired. If you can imagine, I'm making air quotes right now, Trevor.
Yes.
As a tool to skirt the American Indian Arts and Crafts Act. So their goal is to evoke this idea of Native stories, Native authenticity, Native culture, without actually violating the law. And so when we say Inspired Natives, not Native inspired, we're directly sending a dig to the companies who use that term to describe their fake Native products. The history of that term extends way back to 2013 when I was lucky enough to get an audience with the Assistant Secretary for the Department of the Interior at the time and the chair of the American Indian Arts and Crafts Board to try to update the American Indian Arts and Crafts Act to address the way people are finding art now. You know, when the act was established, or I guess when it was reinvigorated the last time, was in the early 90s. And at that time, people were not buying products online. So if you said Native inspired, it didn't have nearly as much consequence as it does today when if you put that on your product on a website or use that tag or use it in your metadata, there's not that much difference between that and actually saying it's a Native X, Y, or Z. So the spirit of the American Arts and Crafts Act is to make sure that Native voices don't get drowned out. And we wanted them to make sure in 2013, Native voices didn't get drowned out. In doing that, making that effort, we realized that we were not going to get help from the people who could help us by reinvigorating the American Indian Arts and Crafts Act. And it was a couple days later that I woke up in the middle of the night and the tagline popped into my head. And I realized the tagline could be a way for us to take this matter into our own hands and ruin the term Native inspired. And so that's what we've tried to do. Now, fast forward, another 10 years after, countless 12-hour days, working 7 days a week, and taking on emotional labor, like the emotional labor associated with the process I just described. I mean, I don't know how to talk to the Assistant Secretary for the Department of the Interior. But I tried hard, and I've always done a good job of consulting my most loyal mentors, Google and YouTube, and have educated myself along the way. Anyway, all that work has led to 8th Generation rapidly taking market share from larger companies who have dominated this market for a long time. And because of that, we've gotten on their radar. They realized that they need to do something now. And most of these companies, rather than changing their business model to work in a way that represents fair trade with native artists, are co-opting our talking points and even the tagline from 8th Generation. And you can imagine how it feels for me to, develop a business model that's not just, it's not just modern business practices and marketing, it's based upon the traditional values and the cultural expectations in Native communities. So when a larger company, I'm talking about $25 million companies, $50 million companies, when they decide to just take the content that is generated organically from my experiences and my upbringing in the Nooksack tribal community is very personal. But we've also protected our content. And so right now, 8th Generation, because we have recently been purchased by the Snoqualmie tribe, we have the legal might to be able to hold ground the way that no other native artist or native company has ever been able to do. And so when we see our tagline being co-opted or talking points being used by these other companies, we'll send a cease and desist and follow up if we need to. And let me tell you, so far, 8th Generation, this small but rapidly growing business started by a Nooksack kid drawing on shoes, is batting 1,000 against these larger companies. And this is a really important point to note, because before 8th Generation, any Native artist that has generated traction with either their aesthetic or a business idea would just get swallowed up in the same way that these companies are trying to swallow us up right now. And we're sort of at a watershed moment, because 8th Generation is having success defending against sort of just the organic way that capitalism can play out on smaller entities.
Oh, absolutely. This system has a way of crushing mm-hmm. the little guy. And what you're doing here is you're merging your art, activism, and business, and taking on the behemoth, taking on the giants. And, what's that? A small axe, cut down a large tree with a small axe.
Yeah, it really is.
Really glad to be hearing all of this and the success that you're having, and hearing it directly from you. You've done so well, and I'm sure the future is going to be bright for you. Your store, you're back open after COVID?
That's true. In March of 2020, we shut down just like everybody else. I mean, we didn't, there was a mandate to shut down, but, we were scared for our employees. We were scared for our customers. And so we closed down. We also adjusted in a number of other ways at the same time. We had really big plans to sort of capitalize on this organic growth that was happening with 8th Generation. So we wanted to develop our infrastructure. We wanted to double our inventory, and all of that got froze. And that had a huge impact on us later on during the holiday season, when we were sold out of about 70% of our product. But what's happening right now is the store has reopened. We're on a reduced schedule. So if you happen to come down to Seattle on a Saturday or Sunday, come drop by and see us. So we have a big neon sign right on First Avenue at Pike and First, and then also one right above the gum wall. So if you follow those neon signs, you can find us. The other thing that is happening is our inventory is getting replenished. So while 2020 was a roller coaster ride for sure, we're now in a position to really sort of be slingshot forward, you know, into the holiday season for 2021.
That is great news. What is the website where people can see, you know, some of the art that you make and some of the designs and some of the artists that you're working with that you're bringing into 8th Generation to do designs for the company? What is the website?
Yeah, the website is 8thgeneration.com. You can just Google 8th Generation. You don't have to worry if you spell it right. It'll pop up. But don't forget the second H in 8th. When I chose my business name and website URL, I forgot how hard that word is to spell. But so watch out for that. But it's
maybe that's why my first email didn't get to you.
It could very well be. One thing that I want to note is that 8th Generation is not just my art. We are a national company, and the Inspired Natives Project was the beginning of 8th Generation expanding regionally by adding Native artists who are vetted by their community. So 100% of our product is designed by Native artists who are paid for their work. And if they need it, they also get business capacity building from me. So if they don't have e-commerce, I help them with it. If they need a logo, if they need help with their taxes, you know, I help them either myself or find someone who can help them. Right now, we currently have about 25 artists represented on our website. And since 2015, when we first launched Wool Blankets, we've made blankets with about 70 different Native artists. That is a huge, so, you know, to start off drawing on shoes and come from the Nooksack community and to create real economic opportunity for that many people is something I'm super proud of.
And you should be. It's great work. I hope to buy one of those new blankets. I saw on social media today you have a new, like, I don't remember what you called them, but a larger blanket, an oversized blanket's coming.
Oh yeah, so 8th Generation, it was very challenging to enter into the high barrier to entry wool blanket market, and so when we started that, we started with an imported blanket, and so it is designed by a Native artist, set up for production by Native people. The logistics are handled by Native people, but it was made overseas. So it's still one of our most popular blankets. We've had that for, 6 years now? But we've added other blankets that are sourced domestically around the United States. And because we've consistently invested in our own capacity, 8th Generation is now able to produce wool textiles right in our Seattle studio. So we're not just creating opportunities for Native artists, we're creating real jobs right here in Seattle. And that's an accomplishment in its own. This is one of the most expensive cities in the country. And 8th Generation is holding its own, you know, in a very challenging business environment and even expanding rapidly and doing ultimately what is one of the most rare things of all, which is reshoring production.
It's an inspiring story, Louis. You should be proud, and your community should be inspired by this. I hope others will, you know, seek you out and you know, come to you for guidance, because I certainly think you are leading the way in this. Congratulations again. Entrepreneur, activist, artist, Louis Gong, really do appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Trevor.
You can listen to past episodes of Times Like Now wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Trevor Collins. I can be reached, trevor@timeslikenow.com. Thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. Please do listen in, like, and subscribe, Times Like Now. And I look forward to speaking with you next time.
Andy Wawa looks a scream. Hand him on my wall. Andy Wawa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Mark Powell. He's the executive director of Capella Romana, and he's here talking about how they survived COVID and their new season, which starts in September. Thanks for doing Art Focus, Mark.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Cappella Romana, how would you describe this kind of choral music?
Sure. So Cappella Romana is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. So for three decades, we have focused on music of the Christian East and West. And this doesn't include things like, gospel music or more contemporary Christian music. This has to do with the music of ancient cultures from Byzantium, so the Eastern Roman Empire, and also from the West, from the Latin world. And so the name Cappella Romana literally means Roman chapel. And so the idea is that we look at both the West and Old Rome, and then the East, which is New Rome, Constantinople, where Constantine the Great moved the capital of the Roman Empire there in the 4th century. And then we explore musics that are related to these traditions. So contemporary music that are inspired by, contemporary compositions that are inspired by this tradition and sort of everything in between.
Mm-hmm. So this is sort of very pure choral music, voices of maybe a dozen people, and then the acoustics of whatever building you're in. One of the first things that happened with COVID was a choir in Washington sang, and an amateur choir, and they all got COVID because they're all spraying, spit everywhere, basically, before we understood COVID.